of the state and the violence of a society that was focused on extraction and exploitation of people. And why do we know this? Because it wasn't just Black people who experienced this. It was white people, it was European immigrants that experienced this. And about 100 years ago, the same people that produced statistics recognize that they should see violence as symptomatic of a capitalist society that is grinding people and that is committing acts of violence in the economy itself. And how to fix that was not through policing. How to fix that was to invest in those communities with pro-social interventions, to give people the economic security, the collective bargaining rights, the right to be seen and to simply be, as I, again, to quote my colleague Kelly Lytle Hernandez. So we are still living with Hoffman. Hoffman's legacy in defining crime statistics among Black and brown people as evidence of their dangerousness and then driving policing as the response to that is still the legacy we live with. It is the infrastructure that we, many of us, are trying to dismantle.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. And I just want to end again. You've got the three guilty verdicts on Chauvin. And then in Columbus, Ohio, right at the time the verdicts were being read, many inside watching those verdicts, a police officer fatally shot four times a Black teenage girl, 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant. That does it for our show. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, thanks so much for being with us. Professor of History, Race, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. KBOO Community Radio would like to thank Matthew, Randall, Margaret, Russell, and Sarah for donating to the spring membership drive today. Join these generous supporters and help us reach our $60,000 fundraising goal by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. I am Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. As you heard our board operator, Ty, remind you, this is our spring membership drive, and we are inching our way towards our $60,000 goal, and you can help us get there quicker. You can, as he said, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can do it the old snail mail way, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Send us a check to that address, where we are still not broadcasting live from. Hopefully it won't be too much longer. We'll be getting back into the studios as people get vaccinated. I've had my two vaccines. I hope you all are going to do that yourselves if you haven't. I know things are opening up in terms of the availability. So I hope everybody heard Khalil Gibran Muhammad and Amy Goodman with that powerful, powerful show. And I'm sure the verdict of the murder by the Minneapolis policeman is on everybody's mind. We are not going to be talking about that. One point of connection that Muhammad mentioned right at the end, that the system of policing is symptomatic of a capitalist society. We are going to be talking about another thing that is symptomatic of a capitalist society, which is our energy system and some of the green illusions that may actually be propping up the continued pumping of carbon dioxide into the air and other environmental devastations in the name of so-called clean or green technology and fighting climate change. To talk about that, today's guest, Max Wilbert, is a community organizer, wilderness guide, photographer, and author. Most recently, he's co-author of Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It, which was released last month. A third-generation dissident, he came of age in a family of anti-war and undoing racism activists in post-WTO Seattle. His essays have been published in Earth Island Journal, Backcountry Journal, Dissident Voice, and Counterpunch, and he has been a part of political environmental work for nearly 20 years. Good morning, Max.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
So before we get into the broader critique laid out in Bright Green Lies, I know you've been involved in the Protect Thacker Pass protest camp on Northern Paiute Territory in Nevada, just south of the Oregon border, since mid-January, and that's a growing resistance to an open-pit lithium mining plan for the region. And I'd like to kind of maybe start with that as a sort of case in point to your arguments against sort of the dark underbelly of green or clean technologies, and then spread it from there. Talk about lithium and what the lithium is used for, and what you all have got against that lithium mining operation.
Absolutely. Well, most people are familiar with mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia, where they blow an entire mountain up to pull out the coal. Most people aren't familiar with the fact that you have to do a very similar type of open pit or mountaintop removal mining to extract different minerals and materials that are required for electric cars. So in this situation in Nevada, there's a proposed lithium mine, open pit lithium mine, that at full size would be about 30 square miles.
That's big.
Lithium mine, yeah, it's big. It's huge. That lithium mine would provide the raw material for electric car batteries and for energy storage batteries for solar power when the sun isn't shining and wind turbines when the wind isn't blowing. This is, you know, a critical piece of the green energy transition. And, you know, I've been fighting the fossil fuel industry for decades now. And I think it's very important for people to understand that the green energy technology industry is an industrial energy production industry. It's an extractive industry. It depends on blowing up mountains, poisoning water, and extracting raw materials from the land. And I don't think that that's a solution. I think that that is basically more of the same. It's more of what has caused the problem that we're in right now.
So I've linked to the Protect Thacker Pass webpage on my program page at kboo.fm. That's Wednesday Talk Radio, so people can find out more about it. But talk about, so where what's the status of that? Is it just at the status of a proposal? How far along has it gotten?
Yeah, the Thacker Pass lithium mine was fast-tracked under the Trump administration. So the environmental review process that would have normally taken 3 or 4 years was done in less than a year, right in the middle of the COVID pandemic. So many of the people in the local community who are most affected by this project didn't even have a chance to participate. And in fact, many of them didn't even know the project was happening until after the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, issued their permit for the project. So this is particularly true on the Fort McDermitt Paiute Shoshone Reservation, where I've heard again and again from people I've been talking with out there that they weren't aware of this project until late January, mid-February, into March, you know, months after the BLM issued the permit. And the reservation was hit particularly hard by COVID. Many people on the res don't have reliable internet access or perhaps any internet access at all. So it's no surprise when they're trying to do these virtual public comment sessions that you're going to bypass a whole sector of the population. And this is, you know, these are people who, this is their traditional territory. This is their ancestral burial grounds. This is, you know, a place where they gather sacred medicines and plants and go hunting and fishing and take their families out to see wildflowers and watch the sage grouse in springtime. This is a very important place, both ecologically and culturally. And the entire area is threatened, not just Thacker Pass itself, but for 30 miles north of there and even into Oregon, into southern Oregon, there's a proposed, another proposed open pit lithium mine that an Australian corporation, these are all multinational corporations, an Australian company called Ioneer, or excuse me, called Jindalee Resources, getting confused with another lithium mining company working in further south in Nevada. Jindalee Resources is planning another open pit strip mine on the Oregon side of the border for lithium. So this entire region really here in northern Nevada, southern Oregon, is threatened with becoming the sacrifice zone for lithium ion battery production.
So let's just stick with the Native American aspect of this for just a second. It's interesting, of course, that Deb Haaland is now the Interior Secretary, and she has the Bureau of Land Management under her aegis. So I don't suppose you've heard any statement from her. Has there been any attempt to approach her that you know of?
There's a committee that's formed on the Fort McDermitt Reservation. They call themselves the People of Red Mountain. Red Mountain is a mountain right next to the reservation there. And they are organizing against the project. We've been collaborating with them and working together as closely as we can. And they are working on letters to Deb Haaland to inform her about the situation and ask that she intervene in this project. It's really a gross violation of human rights as well as, you know, the integrity of the biology of the region. So the opposition has been growing pretty strong in the Native community, not just at Fort McDermitt, but throughout the region. There have been folks visiting the protest camp from the Pyramid Lake Reservation, from Reno Sparks Indian Colony, from the Klamath Tribe, from all over the region. The vast majority of supporters who've come out and visited have been from the Native community. And, you know, that's not a surprise to me. There are still a lot of traditional Native folks in this country, in the land now called the United States, who look at land as sacred and who understand, I think, something that a lot of people in our culture overlook, which is that we are completely dependent upon the planet for every sip of water we take, every bite of food we eat, every breath of air. We are truly the children of this planet. And if we don't respect the planet, then we're going to pay the consequences, and so is everyone else. And that's what we're seeing. So the Native resistance has been strong. It's growing stronger. There are folks coming out this coming Saturday. There's a big gathering happening at the protest camp. If folks are interested in coming out, we definitely want people to join us. You know, for a weekend, for a couple of days, for a week, for 2 weeks longer. And then on this Sunday, there's a prayer run that's starting on the Fort McDermitt Reservation, and folks are running the whole way to Thacker Pass, which is about 50 or 60 miles over the course of Sunday in a relay style.
So regarding the last question on that aspect, before we move on to the book and the broader questions that this particular issue illuminates. So do you know, in terms of like the treaties, agreements, is that, I assume that's part of some ceded territory. Do you know what kind of rights they have under the treaties? One of the big arguments against a lot of these extractivists, whether it's open pit, the tar sands or the oil pipelines that service the tar sands or other big operations, or you name it, that there's issues of consultation with the tribes that is supposed to be engaged. And that was a big issue with, say, the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle and many others, including right here in Oregon. Do you know if that's an issue there?
I'm not a treaty rights expert, but I believe this is all unceded territory. And the Treaty of Ruby Valley that was signed between some of the local indigenous nations and the United States government did not cede territory to the United States. It provided access under certain conditions to the United States. Of course, our entire legal system in this country is built on colonization. You know, all of our property law is built on the idea that the United States, when it was expanding westward, basically had the right to take indigenous lands by force, by coercion, by intimidation, by whatever, guile that people used. And so it's hard to find justice in the courts of the colonizer, for lack of a better term. And so I don't have a lot of faith in the power of those treaties to be enforced, but I think we need to keep building pressure in that direction as much as possible. There is a duty to consult under the National Environmental Policy Act. But like a lot of regulations, the National Environmental Policy Act, it doesn't really have teeth. It's not a very strong law. It requires projects like this to analyze environmental impacts, to analyze impacts to tribes and local communities and air pollution, water pollution, et cetera. But even if the findings are very negative and very harmful, as they are in this case, that it doesn't actually require the project to be stopped. It just requires disclosure of the impacts that will happen. So I think people need to understand that, and we can't rely on these environmental laws. We need to actually do the political organizing work, do the community organizing work to build our own power in opposition to these government agencies that, in many cases, for better or for worse, seem to be captured by the mining industry and other extractive businesses.
Well, again, it will be interesting to see how the new Interior Secretary deals with the many fronts that are no doubt going to be opened up and the many claims for her attention and claims for redress, both historical and current. So that will be an interesting thing to watch. So Protect Thacker Pass, again, that's ProtectThackerPass.com, is that?
.org.
Should have known that. So, yeah, people can go there and learn more about that. If people want to call in and talk about that specifically or other things that I'm talking with my guest Max Wilbert about, then that phone number is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Of course, I do have this KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio Facebook page, which you can like and send me a message at. And let's go on. I just want to read a little bit. This book that you co-wrote, Bright Green Lies, has got a lot of very glowing blurbs from a lot of interesting people, one of whom is Chris Hedges. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to read that one Bright Green Lies exposes the hypocrisy and bankruptcy of leading environmental groups and their most prominent cheerleaders. The best-known environmentalists are not in the business of speaking truth or even holding up rational solutions to blunt the impending ecocide, but instead indulge in a mendacious and self-serving delusion that provides comfort at the expense of reality. They fail to state the obvious. We cannot continue to wallow in hedonistic consumption and industrial expansion and survive as a species. The environmental debate, the authors argue, has been distorted by hubris and the childish desire by those in industrialized nations to sustain the unsustainable. All debates about environmental policy need to begin with honoring and protecting not the desires of the human species, but with the sanctity of Earth itself. We refuse to ask the right questions because these questions expose a stark truth. We cannot continue to live as we are living. To do so is suicidal folly. And that's Chris Hedges. And of course, there, as I said, there's many others, including Jeff Gibbs, who whose film Planet of the Ubans kind of dropped off, raised some controversies, some interest. I watched it. I don't know how many other people out there watched it, but that was kind of a, in a way, a precursor to Bright Green Lies. Maybe you could just sort of talk about your reaction to the Planet of the Ubans and then morph into the main arguments, how that might be similar or differ or whatever to the book we're talking about, Bright Green Lies.
Absolutely. Well, I thought Planet of the Ubans was a fantastic film. You know, a lot of people had critiques of it, but honestly, I think a lot of those boiled down to, I don't like your conclusion, so I'm going to come up with ad hominem attacks against you, or, you know, I'm going to nitpick with one number that you put, you know, 55 minutes into the film that you got wrong. As I can tell you, as somebody who wrote this book, Bright Green Lies, you know, 500 pages of research, 5 years of looking over this information, I'm sure we made one or two mistakes in our book as well. You know, we were dealing with a lot of numbers, a lot of calculations, a lot of data. We really wanted it to be a scientifically sound book as well as ecologically sound and sound thinking. And it's impossible to not make a little mistake or two, but the fundamental conclusion is right on. And Planet of the Ubans points this out as well. You know, as Chris Hedges said in that blurb you wrote, we don't want to try and sustain the unsustainable. And that's what so much of the modern climate movement has become. So much of that movement is no longer about defending the land, defending the planet. It's become about, how do we get more subsidies to solar panel manufacture? How do we pass a law in Oregon or whatever state we're in to provide tax credits to people who buy electric vehicles? People need to understand this is a subsidy to one sector of the industrial economy, and the industrial economy is killing the planet. I don't think it really matters whether your car is powered by gasoline or diesel or a lithium-ion battery. It's an extremely destructive technology, and to think that you can simply switch out what's underneath the hood and all of a sudden everything is fine, that's an illusion. That's a lie. It's something that we've been told. We've been sold this story, and they've done a great marketing job by trying to sell us this story. A lot of people have been convinced of this, and I was one of them. I used to believe that solar panels would save the world, that electric cars would save the world. I really used to believe that, and there's no shame in that. There's no shame in having been hoodwinked by these things, because they're very convincing. You can open up the New York Times, the Oregonian, the weekly paper. You can go on Greenpeace website, 350.org, and you can find story after story after story saying solar panels are going to save the world, and here's how. Or electric cars, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The thing is, none of it holds up when you actually have, you know, deep scrutiny of these issues. And especially when you look at them with a different value system. Because I think that a lot of people are simply asking the wrong question. they're asking, how can we sustain this way of life? Instead of asking, how can we sustain life on this planet? And if your question is, how can we sustain this way of life, then you can justify a lot of atrocities. You can justify blowing up mountains in Nevada to make electric car batteries for, you know, cars, which are luxury products. Most people in the world don't have cars and never have. But if you're trying to think, how can we sustain this way of life? How can we sustain modern industrial civilization? How can we sustain our high energy, highly consumptive lifestyle? Then you can justify a lot of harm to the planet. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, otherwise very intelligent people like Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein and David Suzuki and many others, it seems like aren't willing to make that shift in values. They want to focus, it seems, from their work, it seems they want to focus on saving this way of life, making this way of life more sustainable. Which,
well, I want to get a little deeper into that question, sustaining this way of life, and the whole question of a capitalist system itself, which I think McKibben has been criticized in. Anyway, there's a lot of deep questions that you're bringing up that I'd like to get into, but it looks like we have, oh, I was just going to say we have Paul on the line, but then I got the note that he hung up. So, Paul, if you want to come back, then we can get you on. Otherwise, the number is 503-231-8187. We're speaking with the author, one of the authors of Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. Of course, it'd be interesting to get to what we can do about it. I guess I just want to sort of interject that I actually haven't read the book. I haven't gotten a copy of it yet. I've read some reviews, but I do consider myself familiar with the general arguments and in general agreement. It could be that there might be some things I disagree with in the book, but we can leave that for another show once I've read it. But the whole issue of sort of the co-optation of grassroots environmental and other struggles has been something that I'm very familiar with, and I've seen it myself in here in the Northwest, the movement to protect the ancient forests, the native forests, got kind of taken over by what we used to call the big green groups, who I think is largely who you're criticizing, the Sierra Club, Wilderness Society, Wildlife Federation, et cetera, who, you know, I don't condemn. It's very a very complex argument that I think is worthy of discussion. Is, you know, it's not a quote either or thing. There's a lot of good people, certainly well intentioned, very intelligent people, like, as you said, McKibben and Klein and others, who are involved with these organizations, and it takes some time to sort of unpack the underlying, I guess, worldview, as you talk about. But yeah, like I said, that the earlier what led to mountaintop removal essentially was the failure of the movement against strip mining to actually outlaw strip mining, and one of the huge loopholes, which is enough to blow up mountains through, was mountaintop removal mining was allowed, and that was, you know, again, because a lot of the big environmental organizations took over the fight from, you know, these regional groups that sort of were coalescing and gaining power in the 60s, and they basically hung their hats on one law, the whatever it's called, the Sir Rick, anyway, the law to supposedly reclaim strip mines was the main thing they got out of it. Anyway, and then, you know, jump to the 1980s, and of course this thing is played out in many different struggles. The ancient forest movement got the center of gravity got taken from the Pacific Northwest, got in the hands of the big green groups. They cut compromises with Clinton. And, you know, we did stop a lot of logging. There's no doubt about that. Certainly a lot more than logging industry wanted. But we didn't get the real protection of the ecosystem that we wanted, the grassroots. So anyway, I just want to give my background, how I resonate with what you're saying. But maybe you can respond to that before we go to Joan. Please stick with us a little bit, Joan, but maybe just to sort of respond to what I was saying, and then we'll go on to our first caller.
Yeah, Paul, I think there's a lot of similarities there. You see in the grassroots climate movement today, many of the people who are involved, you know, at the local level, really do have a concern for ecology, really do want to defend the planet. And if it comes down to it, you know, would rather say, okay, let's protect this wild place rather than bulldozing it for industrial solar energy generation. And that's not, you know, that's not a theoretical example. The Yellow Pine Solar Project in Southern Nevada is bulldozing critical habitat for the threatened Mojave Desert tortoise right now, today. You know, many square miles of habitat are being bulldozed. The animals are being dug up or crushed, and it's, what's it for? It's to produce industrial amounts of electricity to power shopping malls and iPhones and data centers and Bitcoin processing and homes and so on, right? And I think many grassroots people would look at that and say, that's wrong. We shouldn't do that. That's not right. And I think it's really important that we all have the right information so we know what is going on in the world. It's really easy for those of us who don't do this kind of research, who don't really dive into these issues on a daily basis, to be hoodwinked if we simply get a newsletter from our electric utility, say, that says our new project is clean and green and sustainable, and here's why. When, you know, the story's different if you're a grassroots environmentalist, if you're a native person, if you're a non-human who's living in the area that's threatened by that project in particular, and who's saying, this doesn't feel any different to me than, you know, a fossil fuel project coming in and destroying habitat and leaving behind a wasteland.
So I looked it up as you were talking. The law I was thinking of was a Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977. But let's go to our first caller, Joan. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi there. Wow, what an interesting discussion. So I'm going to say something that you may already know. A couple years ago on Reveal, which is a program on NPR, I was listening, and they were talking about lithium mining and other types of rare earth mining in Africa and Asia, and saying that these materials, which are being bought by so-called high-tech companies to produce the cell phones that everyone loves and worships, these mines, strip mines, mountaintop removal, some of these mines are run by bandits. And what the bandits do is they capture people, enslave them, and force them to work at these very dangerous mines. They have whole families living there, men, women, and children. The women clean the materials. The men go down into these mines with no shoes, no helmets. The kids are meanwhile assigned to do various things. These people are actually slaves. So when you're using your cell phone, some of the materials are not produced by slave labor, but some of them are, and there's no real way to tell, you know, once the materials are cleaned and produced, which materials that these companies are buying are produced by slave labor and which are not. So this has already been happening, but it's been happening far away in Africa and other places where people are not really thinking about it. And meanwhile, everybody's life is extremely entangled in these devices and in this whole system, which we're becoming increasingly dependent on to live. And, you know, I can't deny that these devices are useful. I'm speaking on a cell phone, although it's not a so-called smartphone. You know, what are we supposed to do is the question. But I think people can't close their eyes to the fact that the stuff that we are dependent on, if it's not ruining people's lives here at the moment, it's already been ruining people's lives in foreign countries. So this was on NPR. This is not a secret. And yet people are proceeding as though everything is just great. And we need to go even further with this. And so you're absolutely right. I'm kind of, you know, stuck as to what to do besides speaking about it. But I just thought I would mention that this goes even further than, I mean, it is appalling that now the things that were overlooked in some faraway country are happening right here in our own state, apparently, based on what you said. That's my comment.
Well, thank you, Joan. Max?
Yeah, thank you for that, Joan. I appreciate your comment. And yeah, you're absolutely right. One of the most egregious examples is cobalt mining in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And much of it is done by slaves in horrific conditions. And cobalt is a key ingredient that's used in electric car batteries, in cell phones, in computers, in the entire infrastructure of the internet, and many other types of modern technologies. Most of the cobalt in the world comes from the Congo. So I think you're right. And as far as the question of what to do about it, that's the big question. And, you know, people have been working on these issues for a long time. And, you know, they're incredibly challenging. They're incredibly complex and interwoven and, you know, multifaceted. But I think, you know, the solutions chapter in our book, Bright Green Lies, is actually short. It's a short chapter, and it's because the solutions are pretty simple. That doesn't mean they're easy at all. In fact, they're very challenging, but they're not, you know, difficult to understand. They're not cognitively challenging. And, you know, I think the solution to these problems is simple. Once again, producing cell phones, producing cobalt, producing lithium, producing the raw materials for this modern industrial civilization we live again is not sustainable. It's destroying the world. It's impoverishing and enslaving human communities. It's driving non-human species to mass extinction. And so we need to stop that from happening.
And so what do you want to go back to the Stone Age? I just want to ask that silly provocative question that unfortunately actually used to get asked a lot when you brought up started questioning systems of modern technology and such as you're doing. But let me just bracket that, and let's go to Harry, who's up next on the phone at 503-231-8187 here on KBO Community Radio. Go ahead, Harry.
Oh, greetings, and thank you for taking my call. I don't know if you know it, today is Earth Day, so happy Earth Day.
Actually, that's tomorrow.
That's tomorrow. Oh, okay. Well, happy Earth Day anyway. You were talking about they fast-tracked the environmental for this project. Is Biden or the administration going back on this fast-track? Because it's not just this lithium mine. There's other things that has gone on fast-track. Is the administration doing anything to put it back to normal?
Great question, Harry. As far as we know, that's not the case. In other projects, in other situations, the Biden administration has put a pause on some of the fast-tracking that was done by the Trump administration. This project was approved on January 15th, a few days before the inauguration. They did that deliberately to make it difficult to go back on this permit. They wanted to rush it through and get the whole permitting process finished at the federal level before Trump left office. You know, the challenge as well is that, you know, the Biden administration is just as much of a capitalist extractive administration as the Trump administration is. And Biden has made electric cars and energy storage that requires this type of lithium a main pillar of his campaign. So, you know, it's a different type of destruction than the fossil fuels that that Trump promoted, you know, pretty much as his main pillar. But it is a type of destruction nonetheless. So regardless, I think people can help out by building pressure on the Biden administration, on the Department of the Interior, and especially on Secretary Deb Haaland. So if folks who are listening, you know, want to call the Interior Department, want to reach out to Deb Haaland and start pressuring her office to, you know, to send this project back, to redo the permitting process, at the very least, I think this project needs to be rejected completely. But at the very least, even if you just believe in democracy and you do think we need lithium, I would disagree with you. But even if you do think that, it needs to be done in a responsible way. You know, even if you believe that the laws in this country are sufficient to protect the environment, I disagree with that. But this project was rushed. It's one of the worst EISs, environmental impact statements, that a lot of folks working on this issue have ever seen.
Okay, and my next question is, I know they do, how much lithium are they talking about extracting from this mine? I mean, do they have any idea how much lithium is actually in the ground in this area?
Yeah, it's a very rich lithium deposit. So the geologic formation is called the McDermott Caldera, which is basically the old Yellowstone hotspot that migrated, you know, up towards the current Yellowstone area over the last 16 million years. So there's a lot of lithium here. This one mine is estimated that it could produce as much as 25% of the world supply of lithium. That number is going to be changing rapidly because the lithium demand is growing exponentially. The demand is growing by roughly 2 to 3 new lithium mines per year at the current rates. And it's expected that that growth will accelerate as, you know, electric cars become more and more popular. So there are analysts who believe that there is not enough lithium, economically recoverable lithium in the world to meet the demand. And that's, you know, that's the growth imperative of capitalism right there. That's the issue with pinning our hopes for stopping climate change on technologies like this, is that when they're existing inside this perpetual growth machine of industrial capitalism, there's zero chance of actually achieving what you want to achieve, simply because of the scale and the never-ending growth that's required to keep pumping these cars out of factories to meet the demand.
Okay, well, thank you, Harry.
Thank you for
go ahead.
My
one more comment. Harry? Sorry, I guess he wanted to say something. I cut him off. But we do only have one other phone line for calls. That's why I guess I'm being a little more abbreviated than usual with my callers. 503-231-8187. I do want to go back to the issue of KBOO sustainability. Personally, I do use the internet. I've got an old time. I actually finally bought a laptop. I really haven't even taught myself how to use it. I'm embarrassed to say, but I do have one of these towers and a monitor that I got from Free Geek, so it was reconditioned. I'd love it if I could do everything that way. I know that's a tiny, tiny, tiny drop in the ocean of devastation and consumerism and waste, but. So I do that, but I really like terrestrial radio. I know that there's extraction that goes on. I'd like to recondition all the radios that are thrown away, not to be able to repair all of them. But anyway, that's my plea for terrestrial radio. I'm not going to condemn you if you're listening online, of course. But I just, there's something about terrestrial radio that I really like. It's kind of a, I don't know, it's kind of like steampunk or something, you know. But anyway, we here at KBOO Community Radio have a spot on a big tower in the West Hills and are able to send our signal out far and wide. We've got two translators out in the gorge and down in the Mid-Willamette Valley. So we are able to reach quite a bit of people. We have a small measure of power, but I don't think we abuse that power. I think we use it wisely. And we have the kinds of things on like you're hearing today, the kind of things you aren't going to hear on NPR. You're not going to hear on a very almost no other outlet. So I hope you appreciate that fact. Maybe you even disagree somewhat, but you're provoked and you like to be provoked into thinking about these things. So give us some of your money if that's available. Go to kboo.fm /donate and help us out, or text KBOO on one of those devices that you may have. Text KBOO to 44321, or you can send us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. We have a modest goal for this spring membership drive of $60,000. I'm actually not aware of how far along we have gotten, but as I say, this is a really important community resource, and we appreciate you being part of that community. With that said, we've got one other caller, Joe. Go ahead. You are on the air.
Hi. I'm kind of late to the conversation and didn't get to hear most of the program, but I caught some of it, and I gather that it has got an Earth Day and sustainability theme. And I wanted to ask your guest about their book and whether they, in their book or otherwise in their work, engage with the degrowth movement and the arguments for strategies that they make around what real sustainability will look like. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, thanks for that great question. We do write about degrowth in the book, and I think we give it a pretty fair play. I think degrowth is certainly far more sane and a far more reasonable approach to the issues that we find ourselves facing in the world today than, for example, what's promoted by a lot of the mainstream climate movement, which, you know, in a broad sense, many of these big green groups seem to think that we can just change the energy source and leave everything else the same, and we'll be okay. We'll solve global warming. We'll solve these different issues. Never mind that the science doesn't actually back that up. The data doesn't back that up. The models don't back that up. There's no evidence that that will actually work. And in fact, there's lots of evidence to the contrary. So I think the degrowth people are really starting to think much more in the right direction. They're starting to question the growth imperative and recognize that, you know, we could deliberately have negative economic growth, negative population growth. We could reduce the amount that we consume year upon year upon year. We could, as a society, make that decision to do these type of things. And I think we need to start doing that right now. It's time. You know, we need degrowth parties taking power in Portland at the city level, at the county level, you know, at the state level, across the world, to start implementing these policies, you know, to start relocalizing our food production, to start, you know, pushing back against these systems that are destroying the planet. And that's going to be extremely challenging because, you know, our legal system is set up to prioritize corporate rights, corporate power. There's a lot of barriers to that sort of degrowth ideology, but it's what needs to happen. And too often we ask, you know, what can I do? What's reasonable? What's feasible? Rather than actually asking what needs to be done and how do we make that feasible? How do we make that reasonable? How do we make it happen regardless of how impossible it seems right now? I think we need to have that vision, you know, that real sense of the future that we're trying to create and how we can get there. And that's challenging to do, but, you know, my hope is that with this book and with the stand that we're taking at Thacker Pass, we can demonstrate to a lot of people, we can help activate a movement, we can help get people organized into actual groups and political formations that can take on this process seriously and start to carry it out. You know, I'm not content with sort of remaining on the sidelines politically and with being a fringe radical who complains basically about what's happening in the world. I think that it's critical that these ideas get implemented in the real world, in the short term. And that's going to take political organizing. It's going to take a lot of hard work. And I think that's basically the work of our generation.
Well, it's inspiring to see, to hear someone who has a radical vision and really does believe that things can change. I guess at 62 and having fought a certain number of battles and seen usually victories eventually in the long run turn into defeat, because let's face it, the capitalists just don't give up. They've got immense amounts of power and capital at their disposal to just keep on in, and to, you know, deploy armies of lawyers, armies of accountants, armies of lobbyists to eventually turn things their way, but not always. But as you said, the you know, what is the vision? So anyway, let's go back to this. As I reiterate the number, 503-231-8187. We only have less than 10 minutes left, so if you want to get your call in, you better get in soon. I did make that flippant comment, so you want to go back to the Stone Age, because, you know, when you start talking about these things, questioning what I call the technosphere, which is this extremely complex, interwoven set of technologies, devices, institutions, mindsets, worldviews, educational systems to the political systems to the corporations to our, you know, the people that pick up the garbage, the people where they take it to, you know, all the, it's extremely complicated. It's grown up over, you know, thousands of years, but especially since the Industrial Revolution, we're all dependent upon it. Many people are, you know, our lives depend upon it. So it's a difficult thing to unpack. People start, you know, want to ask you, well, you know, what if, someone's on life support? What are you going to do? You know, there are very difficult, you know, medical questions or lots of questions involved in this. So, the idea, I think, of solar energy and some of these energies that people have as a sort of transitions to something else, I think is how a lot of people would see it. I mean, yes, there's problems in the production, but we just need to get off fossil fuel, and I guess we can work the rest out. So let me respond to that, but I guess, you know, the deeper question is transition to what ultimately? Before we go to our next caller, Jen, after we hear from Max, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, these are very challenging ethical and moral questions, and we can never beat around the bush with that. So many of us, I wouldn't be alive today without modern medicine. So many of us are dependent on this system. Our food comes from industrial agriculture, you know, our clothing, our housing, everything that we rely on to survive for the most part comes from the system that is killing the planet. That's a problem that we need to collectively work out, right? Because sooner or later, that system is going to end. And it's either going to end because we deliberately decide to change things and make those changes, or because this culture continues doing what it's doing. It undermines the ecological foundations of life on this planet. And the culture collapses. The system collapses in a, you know, chaotic, very violent, very, you know, unpleasant way. That's not the future that we want. And, you know, people like Elon Musk and others can talk about going to space, can talk about, you know, we're going to create this sustainable high-tech civilization. It's a fantasy. It's literally a fantasy. There's no evidence that this is going to happen. Everything is headed in the wrong direction. All of the trends are headed in the wrong direction. So, you know, as far as the Stone Age, you know, it would be one thing for me to have this conversation if modern industrial civilization were making us happy, but it's not. You know, the United States, you know, we're one of the most depressed places in the world. People are alienated. People are dissociated. People feel like they have no community. You know, I was just reading an article yesterday saying most people don't have even one good friend, you know, and that's probably not true of the listeners to this show. But that's the state of this culture, a profound disconnection, a profound, you know, lack of health and well-being. And so I think that when we start talking about what level of technology is sustainable, I think it's easy to sort of get caught in this mindset of what do we want? You know, I really like the internet, or I really like the fact, I mean, I'll be honest, my dad is in the hospital right now. He just went in yesterday with some sort of issue. You know, without modern medicine, he may be dead right now as of this morning. You know, I would never tell him don't go to the hospital or something like that. But I also need to think about this not just in a selfish way, but for future generations. Because I used to live in Salt Lake City, and the medical waste incinerator that was located there right next to the community school that was pumping out dioxins and some of the most toxic known substances in the world, that's creating the medical problems that people then have to go to the hospital for. Right.
Let me. So, I got to cut you off there because we do have Jen waiting, and we only have a couple minutes left. Go ahead, Jen. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Hey, Paul. I really, really want to thank you so much for your show. I listen a lot. I love your show with Jacqueline Keeler. I mean, it's just amazing what you bring. And I want to say, Max, thank you so much for co-writing this. This is amazing to me. I too was somebody who was working in my young 20s, I'm 40 now, to really promote renewable energy, thinking that was the way, that was our solution. And now I'm like, whoa, I was promoting the wrong thing, but that's okay. Like you said, we can move on to what needs to be the solution. And part of what you were just kind of saying about being connected to the earth again, and relating to the earth. I was listening yesterday to First Voices Radio, and I believe that it's the same documentary based on this book, Bright Green Lies, by a woman named Julia Barnes. And
yeah,
great. Well, I was listening to that yesterday, and it was just amazing. And that we can get tickets for that. It's showing tomorrow, correct? And if we go to brightgreenlies.com, we can watch that documentary that's based on this book, correct?
Absolutely. Thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah, and it's I'm going to do that for sure. And what, you know, they asked what was their message that you want to bring to people when they watch this, and she mentioned people becoming more biocentric again, about really about what's benefiting the people at the expense of the living world, of the species, you know, of our brothers and sisters, as the indigenous people are so wise to have known for so long, and to listen to them and to the earth and to the plants and the rocks and everything, like how it holds the wisdom. And she mentioned that we're not disconnected. And maybe it's not her that mentioned that, but it's just other things I'm working on right now with feminine embodiment, and how we just need to learn how to relate again and not necessarily be disconnected. But it's hard because I get caught up in how much all of these things were such a convenience-based society. How do we go back? And I guess it's just more, I think about Wendell Berry too, and how he talked about a healthy community is about being more locally and driving things that we create in a local way. So anyway, I know I just laid out kind of a lot of things, and I just really appreciate, I worked for BART for a while here. I worked for Portland Clean Air for a while and also the original work I did with Citizens Action Coalition in Indiana, it talked about the health effects of the industries, the fossil fuel industries, how much it costs people in their health because of how much we're polluting. And then now it's like how much these extractive industries are extracting Mother Earth for our convenience. So anyway, I just want to say
thank you, Jen. You're going to be the last caller. We only have a minute or two left. I'll give you Max Wilbert, co-author of Bright Green Lies, the last word.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Jen, for that. And thanks, Paul, for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I think Jen's exactly right. You know, a lot of people still hold on to these racist ideas that, you know, indigenous communities and land-based communities that don't have iPhones, that don't have cars, are backward or undeveloped or something along those lines. I think those are the truly advanced cultures. Those are the cultures that have figured out, how do we not destroy the one world known in the universe that supports life? And, you know, I think we need to take a look at those folks and try and learn from them as much as we can. And so I hope that folks will check out the book, Bright Green Lies, check out the film launching tomorrow, brightgreenlies.com, that a friend made on the same topic, and check out the Sacra Pass campaign. It's not that far from Oregon. We really need support on the ground. We need people to come out and camp with us on site, help organize, help fight, you know, not just that project, but help change this entire cultural narrative around these so-called green energy technologies and what's really needed to defend life on this planet.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public